And welcome to the Modern Meltdown podcast. It's Matthew Soule, and with me, just like every other week, is my good podcasting buddy, Tommy Din.
Well, excuse me, princess. Huh?
No. aside from that introduction, we do have a great podcast for you right now.
That's pertinent, man, all right?
It's so dismissive.
It will
become more evident as the podcast goes on as to why Tommy is obsessed with princesses at the moment. But something I'm obsessed with at the moment, this story broke yesterday. I'm so excited to talk to someone else about it. Spider-Man is coming to the MCU.
Oh, shit. That's a long time coming, man.
Oh, it is so cool, man. It is so cool. If you're not aware of the lingo, MCU is Marvel Cinematic Universe. That includes all the Avengers, Iron Man, Captain America, Hulk, Hawkeye, Black Widow, Falcon, you name it. Marvel has it, except for Spider-Man and the X-Men. And now, Marvel and Sony have come together in a marriage to bring Spider-Man into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I couldn't believe it when I read it, man. I've been so excited about it. The Sony email leaks suggested that they were in talks, but it appeared that those talks had broken down. And then suddenly, out of absolutely nowhere, this news pops up. So what do you think, man? Are you excited?
It's hard to tell right now. I have confidence that, you know, Kevin Feige is actually producing the thing. Because the thing is that Sony is still making it, so...
They're making it, but they have very, very limited control over it. And it's like when Spidey is playing around in the MCU, he isn't under the control of Sony.
Hmm. So it's like, it's just the standalone films that are made by Sony.
That's right. And when they are made by Sony, Kevin Feige is the producer, while the old producers are sort of being pushed to the side. Avery Arad has now got the title of executive producer, and in Hollywood that means jack shit. It's just a placating title. Like, you may notice Stan Lee on every single Marvel movie or TV show or animated feature. It says executive producer Stan Lee. Now, he has very little to do with the films. The reason that it says executive producer Stan Lee is because when all the movie rights were being divvied up way back in the 80s, Stan Lee stipulated in every single contract that he had to be named as an executive producer on every single film. And so that's why you see his name in every single movie. So executive producer is really a washaway title. Now, Amy Pascal, who has stepped down from her former position at Sony and is now going into producing, she is going to be producing, co-producing with Kevin Feige for this next slew of Spider-Man solo films. This is probably a good thing. Amy Pascal is a very good producer. Spider-Man, she's seen two iterations of the Spider-Man franchise, be that for better or worse. In this case, I think she gets to be creative. I don't think she'll be held back by any executive decisions or business decisions. And with Kevin Feige there essentially steering the ship, it will keep them on the straight and narrow. And I think that's really, really important because unfortunately for Spider-Man, since the Spider-Man 3 by Sam Raimi, the series franchise has just completely sort of lost ground. A lot of people like to really bag on Andrew Garfield. Me, personally, I thought he was a great Spider-Man. I really, really liked his interpretation. And it seems really sad that they heap all the criticism on that particular franchise. But they got to remember, like, Spider-Man was going downhill since Spider-Man 3. And if we take off the rose-tinted glasses, the only good Spider-Man was Spider-Man 2. And Spider-Man 2 is still pretty... comic booky and not in a good way. So that's all the positive and the negative aside. What does this mean for Spider-Man, Tommy? It means a couple of things are going to happen. So Sony will own the distribution rights and character rights in solo films only. Kevin Feige will produce these solo films with Amy Pascal, as I talked about, and it could include other appearances from MCU characters. So that could mean we could have like a crossover with Iron Man flying around New York City, or, you know, Spider-Man teaming up with Hawkeye for a movie. It sort of opens up the possibilities a bit more. So it gives, you know, there was a really good comic book series called The Amazing Spider-Man Team-Ups, where he teamed up with different people every issue. So that they always worked. So this could be really cool. So this could bring some more life to those solo films. Spidey will first appear in this new form in the MCU first. And sources around the internet have confirmed, and I'm a bit skeptical on this because I'm not quite sure, but everyone else seems to think that he is going to be appearing in Captain America Civil War, which would make perfect sense.
Yeah, that'd make a lot of sense.
Because Spidey was such a big player in the Civil War storyline, and this could be a great way to introduce him as well, because it's a young hero just emerging, and Tony Stark takes him under his wing, reveals his identity to the world, and he then goes over and sort of introduces himself to Cap, who, you know, looks after him after Civil War. If they're playing close to the comic, you know, we have to wait and see how that's going to play out. But I think that's a great way to introduce Spider-Man into this brand new world that he's going to be running around in. Then after that, he will appear in 2017 in his own film, which will be produced by Kevin Feige, so it will stick with the MCU feel. Now, what this does mean for everyone who loved Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man, by all accounts, that is dead and buried. So they're going to be looking at a brand new Spider-Man. Now, I'd speculated before that Miles Morales will be the MCU Spider-Man. It doesn't look to be the case. They have confirmed that it is Peter Parker. But they're looking for a much younger Peter Parker. So expect one of these 18, 20-year-old kids who are just coming up through the ranks, probably a no-name actor. They're probably going to bring him in. And this sort of means that when Robert Downey Jr. does sort of hand over the keys and does retire from being Iron Man, I hope it doesn't happen anytime soon, but when he does, they will probably shift focus to Spider-Man. So much like all these six-picture deals, Tommy, they are looking for someone who is younger so they can actually handle six movies without wanting to branch out and do other projects. Yeah. So
I think it actually makes sense for them to start off with Peter Parker, just because it just with the whole Phase 1, Phase 2 thing, they've stuck very closely to the comic book core. And then eventually, you know, that's going to, when they have to shift over to these new characters, it makes sense to have Miles Morales transition at that point, where all the other characters are doing the same thing. So we're going to get, when we get a new Captain America, we'll have a new Miles Morales, or around that time, you know?
Absolutely. No, that is a very, very good point, because, yeah, I agree with you. Eventually there will be a change of the guard. So Bucky becomes Winter Soldier as Chris Evans goes, you know, to do other projects. Iron Man will probably be passed down to Rhodey, so you'll have War Machine instead. This is essentially what happened in comics, as the A-list characters, as they waned in popularity, eventually the B-listers were brought forth, and this will probably happen in the MCU as long as it continues on. So that's a really good point. Yeah, we probably will see Miles, just not for a long time. Now, one last thing, and we'll have to move on, I guess, because if I'll talk about Spider-Man for the entire podcast, that will really annoy a lot of people who want all the other interesting news that's going on.
One Meltdown, Episode 4, Spider-Man.
So what Sony is still doing, however, is they're still producing Sinister Six, Venom, and a Spider-Girl movie. So I find that interesting.
That's pretty interesting.
That they're still proceeding with these plans. So does that mean in some sort of movie continuity that Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man will still exist? Like, will the MCU and Sony have two different Spider-Mans?
What?
And I think the world can handle that.
I thought Andrew Garfield was like, he doesn't want to do another Spider-Man.
Oh, he does want to do another Spider-Man, but he was very vocal about how he thought that they screwed up Spider-Man 2. So this could be a way for them to retain Garfield as Spider-Man while still having a separate one. So it's kind of like having your cake and eating it too.
I don't know, man. I think that's a bit much, having two simultaneous Spider-Mans. Like, people are going to choose one over the other.
I think they will, but I think audiences would probably take both as well.
I think that's a bit of a stretch.
Because you've got to remember, very, very soon, Tommy, we're going to have a Flash on TV and a Flash at the movies.
Yeah, but TV and movies are a little bit different.
I do agree with you there, but you can sort of see the similarities. Where back in the day, we had Smallville while Superman Returns was coming out. So there is a precedent of having the same character live action at the same time. We're also going to have probably a different Arrow in the movies and an Arrow on TV. So maybe the world is ready. I'm just speculating that they're probably scrapping Andrew Garfield, getting rid of a lot of the old plans. Marvel is... I think what this deal really means, and this is probably my last point, is that Sony is retaining this in sort of name only. Like, this is a good move for Marvel, because what it means is they'll actually be able to increase the budgets, because, you know, Sony will have to contribute a little bit of money towards these projects. And they'll get in association with Sony Pictures credit. But what it really means is that Marvel is essentially taking the character, and when Sony finally does go bankrupt, its movie division finally does kick it, then Marvel is just eventually going to sweep in and completely take the character back. So I would not look at this as in Marvel and Sony working together. I would look at this more as the transition of Spider-Man going back home.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Yeah, that's what I think is going to happen. So I'm glad this news hit, because I would have had to talk about 50 Shades of Grey this week, which I don't have to talk about now, because... That story is so big that it completely wiped that off.
Dude, that movie make a lot of money. Holy shit.
The Spider-Man Civil War, the Captain America Civil War.
What? No, you're just talking about 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, sorry, 50 Shades. Yeah, sorry. Got confused there. Yeah, 50 Shades of Grey is tracking, and this was the original story that we were going to have a chat about, but I'll briefly mention it now. 50 Shades of Grey is tracking to make $60 million in its first week. Now, to put that in comparison, that's the sort of money that you would expect to make from a Marvel film. And because it's tracking so well, Universal are already looking at doing the sequel and the eventual trilogy. So if you're a 50 Shades of Grey fan, congratulations.
I think if your IP gets to the point where Greyhound is making a parody of the trailer, you are in the pop culture mind, or like the general populace mind. Like,
there is no doubting the success of that stupid, stupid franchise. And, you know, my partner Holly was asking me the other day, why is there such popularity behind this franchise? And I don't want to speculate too much, because it sort of is a human nature thing, not really my forte. But I would have to say, Tommy, that we just don't talk about sex enough. And I think that when this book came out, it sort of, I guess, maybe awakened a lot of people to maybe exploring sex a little bit more, or looking at different ways to have a really vibrant and interesting relationship with your partner. And for a lot of people who don't have that, maybe that was like their kickoff. And so that's why it's so popular. And then the other side of that is maybe it's just wish fulfillment and fantasy, like so many other films are. But this hit a demographic that hadn't been hit before. Now, I don't want to generalize. I'm sure it has a lot of fans, but let's just talk about its targeted market, which is late 20s to early 60s women. It's a market that is always completely ignored, Tommy. There are never movies specifically for that demographic unless they're talking down to them. There's never anything racy or sexy for them. So this was sort of like the perfect storm for that market, who always misses out. So I think that has something to do with the popularity as well. But unfortunately, it's here to stay. We get rid of Twilight, we get something completely worse. So fantastic.
We get Twilight fan fiction.
Exactly. Exactly right. Okay, so moving on from 50 Shades of Grey, thankfully. More Avengers 2 concept art has been revealed, and we've finally got a first good look at the Vision. They'll be played by Bentley Jr., who played the voice of Tony Stark's AI Jarvis. So he's going to be actually having a physical role in the Avengers 2. I don't want to speculate too much because this could be spoiler territory for people who really want to enjoy the Avengers 2. Just to say, really, that the Vision is a sentient supercomputer robot who self-actualizes, actually grows and becomes self-aware, and he becomes a really popular character within the MCU. So this is the first time we've actually got a really good look at him. So if you want to check out some artwork, you can check out superherohype.com. They have a full gallery, and I believe IGN also has a gallery up. So don't forget to check those out if you'd like to see what the Vision is going to look like for the Avengers 2. Now, a new IP that's sort of been in development hell for a while. Jennifer Lawrence and Guardians of the Galaxy Chris Pratt are in early talks to star opposite each other in an intergalactic romance called The Passengers. The Wrap has reported that the film, which will be set aboard a spacecraft, follows a man, played by Pratt, who wakes up nearly a decade too early for his cryogenic sleep and decides to awaken a fellow female passenger, played by Lawrence, to save himself from loneliness. Now, although both of them sort of have busy schedules, it looks like they are going to sign up. Jennifer Lawrence may be a little bit more hesitant considering her schedule. So that is going to be directed by Morten Tidlam, who had a very successful run on The Imitation Game, and John Safis, who contributed some of the script to Prometheus, his pen the script. So this has sort of been circulating around Hollywood for some time, been in a bit of development hell. So if you're interested in a new IP, something a little bit interesting, different, this could be same for you, so we'll keep up with that as we go. Here's some really interesting news, Tommy, and I'll be interesting to see what your thoughts are on this. Now, the actor who plays Diggle, David Ramsey, has opened up about discussions that John Diggle in Arrow may actually be John Stewart, who was a Green Lantern, and says that there have been talks with the higher-ups. Now, I find this quite plausible because John Stewart was actually a soldier, so was Diggle, and maybe something happened during the war that forced him to change his name. So what do you think? Is this maybe putting a Green Lantern into the Arrow universe is just too much? It would completely, like, it seems to me that it's something that they might consider when Ramsey decides not to be a staff member, like when he decides to maybe leave to do something else and wants like a guest role on the show.
So you were saying, from what I gather from what you were saying, that he got these Green Lantern powers before he joined up with Arrow?
No, it's afterwards.
Okay.
So, in the comics, John Stewart was in the war, showed great courage, came back into the real world, became an architect, and then he was gifted one of the Green Lantern rings. Now, I would assume what they'd be doing in the Arrow show, if they decide to pursue this path, is that they'll be taking... they'll say that, you know, he is John Stewart, but he changed his name for some reason. And then when the actor decides that he doesn't want to be on the show all the time, that's when they'll sort of write in a Green Lantern storyline where it's like he is given the ring and he has to go off and train, and we'll see him again as the Earth sort of needs it, and he'll sort of pop up every now and again.
Yeah.
That's how I would do it. Because a Green Lantern in the Arrow TV show would just be too powerful, because you really have to consider how often would all the problems be solved if he just whips out his power ring. I mean, that's still the problem with Flash.
Yeah.
Because although I try not to, every time I'm watching Arrow now, I sit there and go, wouldn't this really be resolved very, very quickly if, like, Flash rocks up? And so imagine if you had a Green Lantern there on staff all the time, I don't think it would work. So I do think that if it is going to happen, it's going to happen when David Ramsey decides that he doesn't want to be on the show all the time and takes on more of a supporting guest role.
Yeah, that makes sense. That that show I don't think could handle a more powerful character. Because otherwise they'd have to rename the show, because focus can't be on Arrow if there was someone more powerful there.
Absolutely, and this is why they've always been very hesitant to bring Batman into the Arrow universe. Because when they've talked to creators about it, they're like, look, in our universe, Arrow is the coolest dark character. That's his whole point. So if you bring in a character that's cooler than him, it kind of defeats the purpose. So you can always understand why they're very hesitant to bring in these huge hitters. Now, here's something for you, Tommy, and I'd be very interested to get your thoughts on this. Netflix is making a live-action Zelda series. A person close to the project has described the series as Game of Thrones, but for families. The series will focus on the original game storyline about a young boy named Link attempting to save the Princess Zelda. No writer is yet attached. So, go for it, Tommy. This is your domain, man, not mine.
I don't really know what you're expecting, man. I mean, these are just rumors. There's nothing concrete about it. It's just kind of pie in the sky. Yeah, we want to capture the younger market with a Game of Thrones-esque show. But, that's just a thought. You know, like, I want a robot that gets me drinks.
Yeah, not going to happen. But this would suggest that they do have the rights by Nintendo. So Nintendo is obviously interested in producing the series as well.
I think the thing about Nintendo is that they have such good IPs to branch out to this kind of thing. I think the 90s was a weird time. Like, back then, Nintendo was doing a lot of this kind of stuff. You know, because they had the Zelda show, they had the Super Mario Brothers show. But nowadays, I think the market is a little bit different. So the kids shows these days, and I haven't paid attention that much to them, but it's the quality seems a lot lower for me. Just for what I see on like ABC2 and stuff like that.
I don't think it's going to necessarily be geared towards kids. I think they use the term family so that like children can watch. Like, obviously, you're not going to have your 10-year-old sitting there watching Game of Thrones with you. But the way they're talking about it, this could be a series that adults could enjoy and kids could watch without being terrorized by violence and gore. And
yeah, I don't know, man. Like, the Zelda property is pretty adaptable, because you only need to make three main characters. You need Zelda, you need Link, and you need Ganondorf, and the Triforce. And everything else is kind of just nebulous, in a way. But yeah, like, since there's no writer attached and all that kind of stuff, I can't comment on it at all. Like, I think Nintendo should do it, and if they make a good show, I mean, Netflix, if they're going to make it, I don't think they've done a bum show, have they?
No, they've had a really successful run, and they've got the four original Marvel series coming up as well. So they're on a pretty good run at the moment.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty cool to do, but just as a concept, it's got a lot of legs. But since we're at this stage, there's just nothing to go on.
Well, something that's interesting, I don't know if you've thought about it at all, Tommy, but if this is a success, does this mean we could see more IPs from Nintendo being produced as live-action TV series? And what comes to mind for me would be Metroid. How cool would that be if, let's say, we got like the Battlestar Galactica helmets to do a Metroid TV series?
I think if they did a Metroid TV show, it shouldn't have Samus in it as a main.
It needs Samus. That's
it kind of needs Samus, but you.
Maybe it's like a background figure that sort of pops in and out as time goes on.
Yeah, well, yeah, but definitely not. I don't think she should be a main character.
Because that universe seems ripe for television.
That universe needs to be fleshed out more. Part of what you're thinking about is just this. You're filling in a lot of holes with your imagination. And to you, that's awesome, right? But there's not a lot about that world has actually been fleshed out.
Yep.
Especially in the video games. We just follow Samus very closely. And she's a bounty hunter, right? But she never does any bounties. Except for like the first mission she did when the Galactic Federation told her to kill the Metroids. That was her only mission, and then in every other game since, it's just been kind of her following up on that one mission.
Yep.
So, And, like, you saw the backlash from the gamers when they actually tried to flesh out her character a bit more. And, like, this was the ideas that they had for the character. Like, this was from the creators, right? So, yeah, like, if they did a show, I don't want it to have Samus in it. I would like a fleshed-out Galactic Federation kind of thing, so you saw more of the universe itself and leave Samus for the actual games.
Yeah, that could be a very good point. And sticking with Netflix, and by the way, Netflix, if you'd like us to help you with the Metroid live-action TV series, we're just a call away.
No.
Yeah, I'd be happy to take their money, Tommy. You can come with me as a creative consultant.
I would stab you right in the back if you accepted just any request to do a Netflix
Because Metroid I know... show. Yeah, it'd have to be perfect for you, otherwise you'd absolutely hate it. So I'd go out of my way to make it the most ridiculous piece of shit that I can come up with.
Yeah, hence the knife in the back.
Exactly. So to wrap this all up, I got one more Netflix story for you. Director Baz Luhrmann, who has made a slew of films that you're probably very aware of, Moulin Rouge, for example.
Australia.
As well as... Strictly Ballroom. He's done a lot of those sort of films. Now he's going to be producing another original series for Netflix called The Get Down. And it's a series that's going to be focused on a near-bankrupt New York birthing music genres like hip-hop, punk, and disco. And it's going to be told through the lives of a couple of South Bronx kids. So, believe it or not, this actually sounds appealing to me. I do like historical dramas. I do... enjoy some of those sort of genres of music. So it'd be kind of cool to watch a couple of characters grow with that genre sort of emerging out of like a really destitute New York. I think that could be a really cool setting if done right. Like if they can sort of pull back his love with beautiful colors and just have it just a little bit more grounded. I think that could be a series that could really, really work. And Netflix is just, they're smashing it with their original series. It's a foregone conclusion that Daredevil is going to be really successful when it lands this April. It's House of Cards with Kevin Spacey has done exceptionally well for Netflix. So, yeah, I really do believe that Netflix is just smashing it with these original TV series. And that brings us all the way to you, Tommy, with some really interesting game news.
Okay, in gaming news this week, the Resident Evil HD remaster makes a shit ton of cash, breaks sales records for Capcom, so it would appear that most people prefer the old-school survival horror gameplay of prior Resident Evil games to the more kind of action-oriented ones of the recent sequels, namely 5 and 6. But unfortunately, the trend of releasing remakes as easy cash grabs is going to continue for a while. I don't really see it slowing down. But, you know, I can't be too pissed off at remakes. They're pretty inoffensive when it comes to the shitty things companies do with video games at the moment. You know, it at least allows players who haven't played the game to do so with the convenience of modern-day delivery systems. You know, like, I think Resident Evil Remake is now... you can get it for every single platform and download it, whereas the remake was only available on the GameCube, which basically no one has. So yeah. Another news, Evolve was released this week and is essentially just Left 4 Dead meets your favorite movie, Matthew, Pacific Rim.
It's not my favorite movie.
You love it.
I hate it.
A lot of critics are withholding the reviews, which is pretty rad, because Evolve is 100% multiplayer focused, so to make a proper judgment on these kind of things, you need to factor in how they do the netcode, how the servers can handle the load, and how good the matchmaking system is. So yeah, these guys waiting to put out the reviews is pretty good, is a pretty good sign for the critique of the critiquing side of the industry.
Yeah, it is going to be good, yeah, to see how it actually... I'm really excited. I'm looking forward to this game. I think it could be really cool.
Yeah. As for me, though, despite my love for Left 4 Dead and in this style of asymmetric gameplay, I don't really see myself playing it. As good as the mechanics sound, there are fundamental problems with them, especially in the long run, and with no co-op campaign that was so good in Left 4 Dead. Your experience is basically completely dependent on, you know, the skill level of other people playing. That includes your partners and your opponents. And also the matchmaking system will hopefully help, but I don't think anyone has got it, you know, 100% right. It's also the kind of game that's best with friends, and I have no friends, so there you go. Next segment.
What, man? That's it? That seemed a little quick.
That was all that was interesting. I mean, Activision released a thing where they said they made some more money last year. A new IP from a big publisher was cancelled. More footage and box art was shown for Xenoblade, all of which is really badass, but it's visual, and it's a podcast, so... And, yeah. Anita Sarkeesian is going to be in Towerfall Ascension, but that shouldn't be news, but you have trolls and people who hate women, so... Whatever. Next segment.
Well, that sounds very interesting. That was your rundown for the gaming news for...
Well, I mean, it's all stuff that happens all the time. Like, Activision making money isn't news. New IPs getting cancelled isn't news. So...
It'd be more news when the tons of money weren't being delivered to Activision.
Hey, if Activision posts a net loss of $4 billion, then I'll probably report that, but otherwise,
I think people would be very interested in listening to that.
It's like saying Call of Duty made money. That's not news.
Exactly.
That's not news.
Exactly right. Okay, so moving on to comic book news, somewhere where women are treated a little bit better. Sometimes there are a few controversies at rear.
They are now, anyway.
Yeah, they are now. Yes, that's a very good point. We're trying to stay away from women in the freezers. And if you're a comic book fan, you know what that means. So Marvel has announced a new ongoing Avengers comic that will focus on an all-female cast, and I'll explain why this is cool and why it has failed in the past, but I think this will be successful. The series, dubbed A-Force, features a cast of iconic heroines like She-Hulk, Captain Marvel, Storm, Medusa, and numerous others. A-Force will also introduce at least one new female character, a cosmically powered heroine named Singularity. Now, why I think this is going to be successful than comics that have tried this gimmick in the past, it's actually going to be written by two female creators. And it's also going to have G. Willow Wilson involved, who has had a huge run on Ms. Marvel, as well as X-Men, but he's been doing really well with Ms. Marvel. So they're going to team up with Margaret Bennett, who's worked on Angelina, Ancient of Asgard, Earth 2, World's End. She's going to be scripting the series. George Maloney, I hope I pronounced that correctly. If I didn't, someone will tell me in the comments.
Molina?
Molina. But that is George.
Or you spelled it M-O-L-I-N.
It's J. It's J instead of a G.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going with George, so I apologize if that's not the correct name. Who has worked on Avengers World, Wolverine, and the X-Men. And they'll be providing the pencils. So I think this is great. I think more women writing comic books is fantastic. Because, and this is a conversation I've had with another friend of mine on many, many occasions. He's like, Matt, why are female characters not as funny or interesting in TV or movies or comics? That's his personal opinion, not mine. And I've often said to him, well, I think that the problem is that we have a bunch of white guys writing female characters who have very little perspective on female life. And so as good a writers as they are, and there are some fantastic writers who have written fantastic female characters, I don't think they've ever been able to bring that extra level that's needed for authenticity. And they've never been able to focus on truly female-centered ideas. And I think it's great that Marvel is embracing that audience, which I believe the last stats were like 47% of comic book readers are female comic book readers. But you walk into a comic book store and 90% of the shelf is dedicated to men. So in my opinion, I'm like, bring this on. We need more of this stuff. It's fantastic. I love female characters and I love it even more when they're well written. And I think that's going to be the case with this comic. So support your female comic book creators, pick this book up. Okay, moving on, Marvel has announced that Darth Vader will be getting his own ongoing series. That's going to be from the creative team of writer Kieran Gillen and artist Salvador Laronca. The series will be picking up right after the end of Episode 4 and will show the war from the Empire side. And just cutting in very, very quickly here for our audience, if you're listening to the podcast and you may hear some machinery, that's just because, unfortunately, it seems they're re-tarring our road at the front of my unit. So if you do hear a little bit of stuff in the background, I really do apologize, but we want to get the news to you as fast as possible. Now, here's something that's really interesting, talking about comic book news, Star Wars, Marvel. It's all going to come together here, Tommy, because Marvel has announced another title for their Secret Wars line called Forceful. Seeing as how Marvel has the rights to Star Wars and that Secret Wars is all about universes crashing together, could this be a hint of Star Wars and a Marvel Universe crossover?
Seems like it. If they're calling it Forceful and it's part of the Secret Wars line.
It has happened before, and these tie-ins are always really ridiculous, so I hope it's not.
It's probably going to be fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, that's...
like, I don't see how that wouldn't be.
Like, did you know there was a crossover comic where the X-Men met the Star Trek Next Generation team?
No. How did that go down? Was that ridiculous?
It's always ridiculous. I think the only stuff that I've read that I thought was really good when they do crossovers, and you're going to accuse me of being biased here, and you're probably right, it was Batman vs. Predator. Because that sort of fit. It was like, yeah, the Predator would come to Gotham to hunt Batman.
They had similar tones.
Yeah, it made more sense, but there have been some really ridiculous crossovers in the past. Archie is usually responsible for most of them. They're currently publishing Archie versus Predator. So all of the Archie gang are hanging out on a beach on a nice holiday, and the Predator is there. And I haven't read it, but I assume he's not gutting like Jughead and all those guys. That'd be pretty bad. Yeah. They've also had one where it was a crossover with the Punisher. So the Punisher rocks up at Riverdale because someone is producing, I think it's like crack cocaine in Riverdale, and the Punisher comes to like sort it all out, and Archie's like his sidekick.
Mm.
So yeah, these crossovers very rarely work. So I hope that's not the case, and you know, maybe better heads will prevail, and it hopefully isn't the case.
Yeah. It's like the Spider-Man and Attack on Titan crossover.
Yeah,
somehow happening, which is like at once the best idea and the worst idea ever.
Yeah, Marvel's had this weird relationship with Japan for a long time, and they've had this weird relationship with Spider-Man in Japan. For example, they did a live-action TV series, or it turned into more of like a mini-movie, where there was a Japanese Spider-Man who got his spider powers from an alien, and he also had a transforming Megazord that turned into a race car. So they've always had this really weird relationship with Spider-Man and crossing it over with other things. So, but you never know. Maybe it would work out. But I'm not quite sure how. But we'll see, man. I will pick up the book and I'll.
I think it's probably going to be fun, at the very least, maybe. But I don't know. Depends which universe they use the tone for primarily.
Yeah.
I guess.
It will be interesting to see.
It has to be fun. Like, you can't just shove Spider-Man into the Attack on Titan and expect it to be...
And then, like, a top...
Gritty. Like, it doesn't make sense. I don't know. It has to be... It kind of has to be jovial, doesn't it? I don't know
how they're going to do it. I think we'll just see a bunch of Marvel characters getting eaten by Titans.
That'll be all right.
Yeah, well... Yeah, we'll see what happens. Now, the huge piece of comic book news, and we're actually going to talk about this a little bit later on in the show. So the New 52 has ended. So stick with us, and we're going to discuss that in depth in a little while. Before we do that, however, Tommy, you have an interesting story coming from the EA executives.
Okay, so during the DICE Awards, or the DICE Conference, or something that happened around this week, an EA exec said that games are too complex. They're too difficult to learn. In you know, a grander context, he's quoted as saying, "Our games are still too hard to learn. The average player probably spends 2 hours to learn how to play the most basic game." Now, he said this in response to a comment that it would be nice if games had a consistent button layout across games, even from different series. Now, my response to this is, one, basic as in what? Because Mario is basic, and there's no tutorial needed for that game. And two, don't make your goddamn tutorials 2 fucking hours long. Now, like, for me, I can just leave it there. But I figured I'd get your input on it, since you primarily play these types of games, these AAA games, where the player is basically treated like an infant. So, yeah, what's your experience with these tutorials been like?
So, for me personally, I would say that the tutorials aren't really as in my face as they are for you. But, I mean, you're a game designer, you're playing a lot more games than I am, so that sort of really plays into that a lot. Mm-hmm. I found that, you know, tutorials, for me at the most, it's sort of distracting for about 10, 15 minutes, and then you're straight into the game. So, yeah, I don't think that it's really a big problem for me, and probably not for a lot of casual gamers. But the thing that I sort of found a bit confusing there is his statement that it takes 2 hours long. 15 minutes, man. It takes me 15 minutes, 30 minutes at the most to learn a game. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think it should take 2 hours. I mean, like a 2-hour block at the start, at least, anyway, to learn anything. Game mechanics are generally either immediately apparent, like, you know, pressing the jump button to jump. You press it and you just know what it does. Or for things like leveling up systems, you know, those things are kind of learned gradually. So, like, you level up, you earn a new skill. Using that skill, you learn that as you go. So as you accumulate skills, you're just learning as you get them. So, yeah, like, it's weird that he also said that, like, this applies to the most basic games. Because when you think about basic games, you think about Mario, you think about Bejeweled or Peggle. These games you can figure out basically as soon as you see them. So I have no idea where he's coming from with that. Like, if he's talking about, like, if he considers a game like Battlefield to be one of those basic games, even that shouldn't take 2 hours to learn the mechanics. I think it's a failure in design if that's the case, because especially nowadays with control methods for 3D games being pretty standardized. I mean, like, the commenter said that this was what he wanted, and you know, he wanted to have these kind of standardized things throughout franchises and all that. But I'm thinking that it's basically already here. You know, like, the control methods for things like Halo and Gears of War and Call of Duty, they're pretty similar. The only changes are certain buttons for certain context-sensitive things. And on, like, if you take, for instance, stuff on the PC, pretty much every game, even outside of first-person shooters, the WASD keys are used for movement. That's true in, you know, Call of Duty to things like, you know, The Binding of Isaac or whatever. From 3D to 2D, it's the same. So, yeah, I don't know where it's coming from with that.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but I mean, I guess from the perspective of someone who's been gaming for a very long time, you know, so if we think about things from the other end of the spectrum, someone who hasn't played a game before in their life, this maybe becomes a problem that's harder to deal with. How do you teach these players while not pissing off the returning ones? So you've always got that balancing act between how much do we baby them, how much do we sort of just let them figure it out on their own.
Yeah, again, I think it's all part of how the game is designed. You know, there are many ways to approach teaching the player the controls. I think most games in the AAA space nowadays default to this pretty standard, you know, you have, you know, an action-packed first level, you know, that has on-screen prompts for whatever button to press when. So, for example, in Destiny, the first level has the player just like kind of waking up. They have no weapons or anything, and they're just walking. You know, you're told to just go someplace. They don't tell you specifically what to press to move, because that's pretty standard. So what happens is you move along, and then eventually you reach a point where, you know, the AI guy is saying, quick, we have to hurry! And then an on-screen prompt will say, press shift to run. Or press this button down to run, or whatever. Now, I think the reason why this is the case is because on-screen prompts are the thing that are going to piss off the returning game the least. They aren't stopped from the action, and although it's kind of annoying to see it, it can be, it's ignored so easily, right? But at the same time, it also makes absolutely sure that everyone knows what button does what in the context required. Now, the problem with this general approach is that it always makes the first level of the game a trudge to get through. They kind of always make it part of the story now, so that you always start off with nothing, and then you're just trudging through and then have to go do all the stuff like learning to shoot and all that kind of thing. So on replays, that's really annoying. Like, I hate the on-screen prompts because it's something that immediately takes you out of the game. Especially in instances like later on when, like, for instance, these on-screen prompts, if they're used in the tutorial level, that's fine. But in a lot of games, they persist throughout the game. So whenever you, like, walk past the turret, it'll say, press X to get in the turret. You know, when you see that text, it just takes you out of the game saying, oh yeah, I'm playing a video game. Right? So if it were up to me, the first level would just depend on basically whatever the hell worked in terms of what kind of story you wanted to tell. You know, so if you wanted to start the game off in a siege or, you know, a player getting ambushed right off the bat, you know, do that. Do whatever works for the story that you want to tell. Now, teaching the player the controls through this means is a bit difficult because you're throwing them right into the mix. But the way you can teach them the controls is to just have, like, a screen that displays right before the game starts that details the button layout. Like, you have the controller there, and then you have, you know, lines and, say, movement, point to the joystick, and, like, X and a line saying action button or shoot button or whatever. And you can also have this screen be accessible from the pause menu so that if the player, you know, can't remember what to do, they can, at that point, they're already out of the game. So they'll pause it and then they'll look at the button layout and go, oh yeah, I need to press that. So there's no real break in kind of immersion, because once they're confused, they're already out and then they'll look for an answer. And that's how the manuals used to work back in the day. And, if we look at even the more, like, complex games, and I don't know whether he took this into account, because EA does have, like, the Sims franchise, and that's pretty, in terms of the amount of stuff you can do at once, that's somewhat complicated. But, you know, for similar games like Civilization, they have a pretty good way of doing, going about teaching the player what to do and not annoying the experienced ones. What it does is the game just asks you what level of experience you think you have with the game at the start. And you can alter this at any time in the settings. So you can just choose the novice option and then the game will stop more often to tell you what kind of things you can do. So at the start of the game, it'll ask you what kind of... It'll say something along the lines of, what experience do you have with Civilization? You know, no experience, a little bit of experience, or whatever. And if you choose the novice option, then... Yeah, the game would just stop and say, okay, this is what does this, this does that. And you, for the experienced player, you can just say, I'm an experienced player, I know all the stuff. And that's it, you don't get any of the hand-holding. And all of this is done before the game starts. It can be turned off at any time, which is it's very quick, it's very easy, and it conveys all that needs to be done without kind of getting in the way of the game itself. Now, I think you could do a similar thing with the FPSs, so... You could integrate that into like a Battlefield or the next Call of Duty, where that's an option at the start. You know, in the first level, if you choose the novice option, the game will stop during the mission and tell you things like, you know, press this button to do this. This, you know, the graphic element does this here. And it kind of just stops you at the right point in time. And if you have the expert option on, it doesn't do any of those things. It just progresses as normal. So... Yeah, I think that's my solution to it. It there's probably some, you know, from people who have like zero experience with games, there might be issues with that. But that's what I would do if I was making a AAA FPS right now.
No, I think that's a really good idea. It's sort of a compromise between both ways of playing. So for your advanced gamers who know their button layouts, you know, select that mode where it's like, look, I don't need any help at all. And then for people who are just playing, it's like, yeah, I need a shit ton of help, so I'm going to go in as novice. No, I think that's a really good way of doing it. And yeah, so that's sort of really interesting look into the way that CEOs are thinking about video game design.
And my huge rant on tutorial design. Anyway, that's I think we covered everything on that topic. So yeah, let's move on to the new 52.
Well, actually, Tommy, it's the end of the new 52. The 52 is gone. Now, this is let me just talk about the new 52. What it was, what it meant for comic book readers, what it meant for people who aren't comic book readers. When the new 52 started, it was the idea to take at least 25 years of backstory and clean them up. And Marvel and DC have actually been doing this for many, many years. DC was the first guys to try and do it. I've talked about this on an earlier podcast, so I won't go into it too much detail. But what DC Comics decided to do was go, okay, look, we've got 15 different titles for different characters. Some, you know, we've adapted histories, we've changed histories. You know, in one set of books, Batman has a daughter. In another set of books, he doesn't. In this set of books,
Alfred.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, in one set of books, Alfred Pennyworth is a big, fat, bumbling private detective. So they had to discover a way of how to trim the fat and get a solid continuity. So what they did is they created a miniseries called The Crisis of Multiple Earths. And that was an attempt to take all of the different characters, all of the multiple Earths, and put them into one cohesive universe. So the multiverse was destroyed, and all the survivors that they wanted to keep came from all the other Earths. They put them onto Earth 1, or Earth Prime, and that was it. They left it as is. And that meant that they were able to, you know, completely trim the fat on the universe. Let's kick forward about 12 years later. They decide that that wasn't as great an idea as they liked, so they created a book called Infinite Crisis. And that's where a couple of the survivors who were trapped in a pocket universe from the first event broke out and decided to try and bring back the multiverse, to bring back their homes. So they did actually succeed in that, and they split the Earth into 52 parallel Earths. So then they started playing around with the parallel dimension idea again. And over the next, you know, again, another 10 years, it got, again, a bit convoluted. So what they decided to do was they created another miniseries. See a pattern here, Tommy?
Yep.
And they decided to create another miniseries, which involved the Flash going back in time to prevent the death of his mother. And that created an alternate timeline. And the Flash then had to correct this timeline. And then what that birthed was the new 52. And the new 52 was no longer going to be beholden to 25 years of comic book history. They could essentially cherry pick the history and story elements that they liked and revamp the characters who they felt hadn't been doing very well. And so the new 52 was launched. And it was named the new 52 because there were 52 multiple parallel Earths, and because there would be 52 books in the launch. So this created somewhat of a controversy for a lot of people, because everything went back to being numbered right back to number one. So that meant that people who had been collecting Batman for years and years and years would never eventually get to their issue 1000. They would go back to issue one. So from a collective standpoint, this pissed off a lot of people. Now, from a storyline perspective, this sort of upset a lot of people as well, because they were losing some of their favorite elements of the characters. So, for example, just talking about Batman again, because I am a Batman fan, this is where my encyclopedic knowledge will come from. What happened with Batman was that he'd had multiple Robins. Now, when it came to the new 52 version of Batman, not all of those Robins existed, or not existed in the way that we had read before. So one of his Robins was never Robin at all. He was Red Robin. I know that doesn't seem like much of a difference, but that meant that he'd never essentially donned the Robin costume. He'd created his own persona. And so his history was sort of really eliminated. Dick Grayson never ventured out and created the Teen Titans, for example. So that part of his history was eliminated. However, they did keep Damian Wayne. But at the same time, they suggested that Batman had only been operating for 6 years. So in 6 years, he'd had like five different partners, as well as raised a child. And it didn't sort of really gel a lot with a lot of people. Like they sort of thought, okay, yes, in cherry picking what you have, you've sort of cleaned everything up a little bit, but at the same time, you've also created massive inconsistencies within the history of the characters. You know, Oliver Queen was sort of one that really got hit, where it became that the TV show was actually a better representation of the character than the comic book. So a lot of these characters probably suffered from the New 52. Barbara Gordon was no longer paralyzed. She'd healed. And I don't know if you know much about DC Comics, Tommy, but they have no respect for back injuries because people miraculously heal from them.
Yeah, Batman, like in the movies with Bane. Yes, yeah.
Exactly like the movies when Bane snaps Batman's back and they just like hang him up and punch him in the back. Now, this is something I also share with Batman in that respect. I actually have a protruding back disc. And I can tell you right now, Tommy, if someone punched me in the back, it's not going to help.
No.
At all. Although it might. Maybe I should investigate that. But that's neither here nor there.
No, it's a bad plan.
So a lot of the comic book characters lost a lot of significant parts of their history. And this sort of upset a lot of people. But at the same time, it did also clean up the continuity so that it meant people who were just discovering comic books from movies could essentially jump into it and not be overwhelmed.
Yep.
Because I mean, the problem, for example, like, now, I mean, this might blow up in my face here, but when I say Batgirl, who immediately comes to mind for you? Vague description of the character would even sort of fit here for my example.
Okay, yeah, it's Batman but a girl.
Okay, maybe
I don't know.
That did blow up in my face a little bit. that's because.
Sorry, I'm a bit out of it.
No, that's cool. Like,
my mind's just kind of wandered off somewhere else.
It's more because you're not a huge comic book reader, so.
Also, that might have something to do with it as well.
You know,
yeah,
and you probably don't know much about the expanded universe, which is cool. But for a lot of people who, say, for example, grew up with the 1966 Adam West Batman series, they would identify Barbara Gordon, who was the police commissioner's daughter. Well, eventually she was retconned to be his daughter. She was the niece first. But people associate that character with red-headed Barbara Gordon. Now, over the years of continuality, there had when I was still reading it, just before the New 52 started, there had been three Batgirls already. So what the New 52 was attempting to do was bring it back to what people knew as the characters. So instead of a blonde-haired Stephanie Brown as Batgirl, it was back to Barbara Gordon, redhead Batgirl, the Batgirl that we all know and love.
Okay.
That's what they were trying to do. They were trying to make it more recognizable to people. You know, it was like Superman. People for years and years had been commenting about how silly the underwear on the outside was. So they got rid of it. You know, they sort of found these little things that they could sort of tie up and make it a bit more modern and try and make it fit in more with the movie universe that they were going to go on to create.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to controversy, but it also led to more accessibility, which longtime fan comic books hate because they're like, I've been with this for 20 fucking years. I don't care that you've never read a comic book before. I don't care. This is my thing. Stay away from it.
Yeah, people should cater to me because I've been here the longest. Exactly. The same shit we deal with in video game culture too.
Exactly right. And the problem with that culture and what they don't seem to get through their thick skulls, and if you're listening to this and you're getting really angry, I'm talking to you. I'm directly talking to you. The problem is, if we don't have new people coming up through the ranks, the things that you know and love will disappear. That was always the problem with the crash of the 1990s comic book market, was the fact that we had a bunch of books coming out that was so over the top, that was so convoluted, that people trying to experience comics for the first time had no friggin' idea what was going on. You know, we had like the clone saga for Spider-Man that ended up lasting 3 years. Could you imagine jumping into a crossover that had been going for 3 years, Tommy, and trying to know what the hell was going on?
Yeah, I wouldn't have done it.
Exactly. It just became so much of a problem for comic books. So, yeah, when I say that we every now and again comic books do have to clean themselves up so that new people can enjoy the stories, if you get angry about that, you're part of the problem, not the solution.
Well, yeah, so, it's also the other problem with it as well is that, like, it's so single-minded where it's just like, I want to be catered to, I like these stories. But you have those stories already, right? In terms of art and stories and all that kind of stuff, in video games, comic books, movies, we need to tell different stories, explore that character in a different light. And you can't get that if you're just catering to one market. That doesn't, you don't get this evolution, you don't get this progression.
Exactly right. Like, a lot of people complained that Iron Man 3 did not do justice to the Mandarin. They're like, this isn't the comic book interpretation. Now, for me, and I mean, again, this is a whole separate issue, but I do want to sort of touch on it a little bit here, because we are talking about this sort of controversy. The problem with that is, which continuality do you want movie makers to base it on? Superman, his origin, although stays similar each time, has been revised many, many times. The Mandarin started out as a racist stereotype. I mean, for Christ's sake, he was called the Mandarin.
Yeah, I think if they did that truthfully, I guess, to the comic books, that would have fell very flat on the screen.
And not only that, it would have fallen very flat with these people who are demanding their original origins. They don't want their... What I want people to sort of start... When they do discuss origins and stuff, you don't want the original character origin on screen. What they want is their era of that character on the screen. That's what they're after. And the problem is that their era of Batman is not going to be my era of Batman, and it's not going to be my son or daughter's era of Batman. And that's the problem, is that they need to understand that when they reinvent, when they reinvigorate or they clean up timelines, it's so that the next generation can have their version of the character. And they sort of need to back the fuck down and sort of start realizing that that is the case, and they need to chill out. And it's like you said, their stories aren't gone. Their paperbacks, their single issues are all still under their bed. Those stories are always going to be there to enjoy. But they sort of feel a disconnect when they have to clean up, and I'm not sure why they feel that way, but that's the way they do. So, you know, we've sort of discussed with the New 52, we've discussed the controversy, the character developments, and the continuality. Now, the real question that I had with the 52, and this is probably a lot of the 52 has been going on for 5 years now, and people are saying, did it go on too long? Did they milk everything they could out of that imprint? And is now a good time to drop the imprint as well? That's probably the other question, is has it not gone on long enough? Now, as a comic book collector, a reader, I think maybe they did carry it on for too long. I sort of thought, okay, call it the New 52 for a year or maybe 2 years, sort of really drive it. Like, this is new, these are the characters. But we're now talking about nearly 5 years of continuality. I think it's just hitting year 4.5 now.
Hmm.
So it no longer was new, and it no longer sort of fit with what they were originally sort of going with the New 52. Like, the characters have changed. Their origins may have harkened back to the old days of the continuity. So was it a huge success? I think in the first year it was. I think sales-wise, it was an enormous success. Was it a success 3 years later? No, because it wasn't new anymore. It was old hat. So yeah, they sort of continued on with this brand. And now some people on the opposite end of the spectrum have said, is it a good idea to get rid of the New 52? Because they're talking about how the New 52 brand has sort of created awareness, like people have it as brand awareness. And I sort of, again, I go back to that original point, you know, just because it says New 52 doesn't mean people still consider it new. So I think now is the best time, and they probably should have done it a couple of years earlier. They should have dropped that whole brand New 52 thing. Because like yourself, Tommy, like if you'd been going to comic book stores for the last 4 years and saw the brand New 52, would you still consider it new?
It still seems new to me. I was very surprised when you said that this is 5 years in the running. And I just looked it up, and it's like, yeah, it launched in 2011. I'm like, holy shit, this seems like it was just yesterday that they released it. Because well, yeah. I guess, like, the New 52, you just, like, when I first heard about it, it was the New 52. And in my mind, it was just like, oh, yeah, that's new. As in, right now, that's new, right? So, yeah, but it's... For me, I'm kind of used to this because Nintendo do the whole New Super Mario's bullshit where they're still releasing, like, they released New Super Mario Bros. For the Wii U, and I'm like, stop fucking calling it that.
Yeah, just Mario.
Like, it shouldn't be called New Super Mario Bros. It just should be called, like, Super Mario Bros. Wii U or something like that. Don't put new in the title. It's just dumb. Like, eventually that's going to become old, like the New 52 has, you know? Like, 5 years is... 5 years in the running is not new.
That's a long time because, I mean, what was interesting about the New 52, and I know for, like, yourself, you were like, wow, it just seems sort of like yesterday that they were discussing this.
Mm.
It feels like just yesterday I moved to Canberra, but it turns out that I've actually been here going on 5 years, Tommy. Like, you know, it feels like just the other day I was dating Holly. We'll be, when we do get married next year, we'll have been together for 5.5 years. Like, you know, time does sort of like creep up on you, and it did definitely creep up on the New 52. So DC has to fill in the blanks now. Where does the DC universe go from here? Good news and bad news. The good news is that most of the titles from the New 52 that you loved are still going to be happening, but yeah. There aren't going to be 50 new titles anymore. There are actually going to be 42 titles. So they're obviously trying to save money and promote bigger printing runs of their popular comics.
Yeah, makes sense.
So that means that what is going to be focused on is not going to be the comics that just didn't do well. Like they kept – one of the things that really sort of annoyed me was that they kept trying to bring back – and I mean I'll be interested to see what you think about this one – they kept trying to bring back war comics.
So like, war comics is in those big events where you have like
all
the characters fighting each other? Or?
No, war comics is in soldiers fighting in Iraq.
Okay. That's pretty interesting.
And it never worked. And they kept trying to bring it back. And I was sort of like, because, you know, they started out with like G.I. Commandos, I think was the first time. And then that didn't work out, so they renamed it to Nick Flag and the Commander. And it just, they just never quite got it working, you know, which is, yeah, it was odd that they sort of kept trying to come back to that way of thinking that people would still love the old... yeah, that they would still love that old style of soldier, western-y. That they try to do western comics as well. You know, and I felt that these are comics that are just of a very bygone era. And, it seemed very strange to me. But what's cool is they have announced a couple of new titles, and I'll read them off here and sort of talk a little bit about what each title means. I won't take too long on it.
Sure.
So we're getting some brand new titles, so some brand new comic books. Batman Beyond, which is fantastic, man. If you don't know what the Batman Beyond character is, it first came out of a little cartoon series. So Warner Brothers decided the animated series, while good, was not appealing to a younger demographic, so they asked those guys to reinvent Batman for a younger audience. So what they did is they focused on a retired Bruce Wayne training up Terry McGinnis, who would become Batman of the future or Batman Beyond. So it's really, really cool that they keep going back to this character, because it's a character that I absolutely love and I think it's fantastic that he's still in comics. Cyborg is coming out. Now, Cyborg is going to be a movie in a couple of years, so they're probably trying to capitalize on that. They definitely are promoting Cyborg as a character. He is very interesting, so it is cool. It's also good to have a minority character getting his own title. I think that's important as well.
Yeah, cool.
We've got a book called Dark Universe, which I assume is based on like Constantine and Swamp Thing, their sort of shared dark magical sort of universe. Got a book called Doomed. No idea what's going on there. Because a lot of information hasn't come out yet. So these are just titles. We've got a Harley Quinn Power Girl team-up book. I don't know why. Power Girl has never been a particularly interesting character. Every now and again she has moments, and the Harley Quinn books have been terrible. So I don't know what pairing them up is going to do other than make me, like, I mean... Like, Holly, who is a Harley Quinn fan, does not get the Harley Quinn book. So adding Power Girl...
That's the sad set of affairs.
So adding in a giant pair of tits is not going to help Holly pick that book up. And that's the market they're meant to be going after. So good on you, DC.
Oh, well, maybe they'll put some good people on it and it might be good. Who knows?
Maybe.
Have hope.
We'll see what happens. But I think they're going to stick with comedy, and that just doesn't seem to work for that book. We've got Red Hood and Arsenal coming out, which just seems to be a rebranding of Red Hood and the Outlaws, as Arsenal and Red Hood were on that team.
Mm-hmm.
However, they're separating Starfire out of the Outsiders. She's getting her own book, which is good because Starfire has just been so underdeveloped, and she was a great character, and they need to have a look at, you know, fixing that up. There's an interesting book title, Tommy, called We Are Robin. So maybe this is like a Robin team-up book where they get like the Robins of the past and the future and they gather them all together to sort of, you know, maybe work together as like a Batman unit or something. I'm not quite sure, but that does sound cool. Anything Batman is okay by me.
Yep.
So that those books that I've just talked about, they were exclusively announced by IGN, so we've got to give them that news credit. They do some good work. Now, the rest was announced by CBR, which is Comic Book Resources, and Newsarama. So these are the books that we've pretty much had before. Justice League of America, they've got a book called Bizarro coming out. There's a Bizarro universe where odd interpretations of the character live. Bizarro Superman, he speaks in backwards sentences. It's all kind of a bit silly, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with that particular book. A book called Prez, no idea there. Omega Man, Mystic U, Section 8. Dr. Fate, that could be very interesting. Dr. Fate was an Earth 2 character, so hopefully they're setting him up in the Earth 1 universe. Robin, Son of Batman, so that'd be a series focused on Damian Wayne. Black Canary, probably coming off the success of the Arrow TV show. Martian Manhunter, who's really been sidelined in the New 52, so it'll be good to see him come back into the front. Earth 2 Society. Earth 2 has been on the path of destruction now for the last year and a half, and it still hasn't been destroyed, so I'm not sure what they're going to be pulling with Earth 2 Society. Midnighter, again, no idea. Batmite, which is very curious. Batmite was a little 1970s character who would pop up. He was like a little imp from the fifth dimension, and he was a huge fan of Batman. And it's sort of like something from a bygone era, so I'm not sure what a Batmite comic would be about. Maybe it's for kids, I'm not sure. Constantine the Hellblazer, so after the success of his TV series, he's getting his own comic again. Justice League 3001, so that's Justice League from the future. Green Lantern Lost Army, again, not sure what's going on there. And the list of ongoing titles that are still sticking around, so this is where people can start breathing a sigh of relief. And I'll run through these very, very quickly. We've got Action Comics, Aquaman, Batgirl, Batman, Detective Comics, Batman, Superman, Catwoman, Deathstroke, Flash, Gotham Academy, Gotham by Midnight, Grayson, Green Arrow, Green Lantern, Harley Quinn, Justice League, Justice League United, Lobo, Secret Six, Sinestro, New Suicide Squad, Superman, Superman Wonder Woman, Teen Titans, and Wonder Woman are all going to be continuing. So if they are your books that you love and you're worried that they're going, you don't have to fear for that anymore. So that's pretty much a wrap-up where the universe goes from there. I'm sure they're going to just continue on the really great storytelling that they've been doing for the last couple of years. Scott Snyder's work on Batman is just fantastic. It's phenomenal stuff. They've had some really amazing runs with Superman, and the Wonder Woman run was also critically acclaimed. So definitely go check those out. Jump on comic books now. It's a great time to get involved, especially with all the movies coming out.
Yeah, with that being the case, why don't I think it'd be cool if you do you have like certain series or like runs of books or whatever that are in the New 52 that were really good, just before we kick it to the curb for the last time?
Yeah, absolutely. What I would recommend is go right back to the start of the New 52 for Batman. You can get all those stories now in a graphic novel. They were written by Scott Snyder and they were drawn by Greg Capullo, and they were fantastic. The best Batman story writing in the last 10 years. So you've got Court of Owls, you've got Death of the Family, and I believe Gotham Zero Year is now all out in graphics, so check those out. They were a big pull from the New 52 that I thought was really, really good. Suicide Squad was fantastic. Some of the series was hit and miss, but the early days were really good as they were developing the characters. Aquaman was critically acclaimed. It was fantastic. Anyone who's really interested in Aquaman sort of like says, oh, this is a crap character, you know, never pay any attention to him, check out that initial run of Aquaman comics. They were just phenomenal. Justice League was good because it reintroduced the characters as well. So I would recommend that if you are interested in a character, go back, look at their first graphic novels in their New 52 run, and that will actually bring you up on how that character sort of got started. So good jumping on point for people. But yeah, cannot recommend the Batman run any higher, man. It's award-winning. It's just been fantastic. It's been covered on podcasts. It's been covered on the news. It's been covered by every single web page. Everyone loves them. And they've been Capullo and Snyder have been doing this for, I think, now nearly 5 years. And the quality never dipped. So that would be my pick.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And speaking of Batman, Tommy, are you ready for this week's movie trivia?
Sure. You did really. It's no Street Fighter, but I'll take it.
It's Dark Knight, and I figured I'd pick a movie where you would actually have a fair knowledge of, because, you know, you can't call yourself a nerd or a self-respecting comic book geek or pop culture aficionado without checking out that movie. So I've developed 6 questions for you, Tommy, to test your... I'm not really testing your intelligence. I'm more just... I'm testing your instincts.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
That's what I'm testing.
I'm not entirely comfortable with this, but all right, let's see where this goes.
We'll see how we go for this one. Okay, question number one, true or false? Heath Ledger designed the eventual makeup that the Joker would use on screen.
Okay. So most of these are going to be outside of the film, or kind of nebulous.
They'll be around it. Some of the questions will be sort of rotating around it, yeah.
Okay, so I think there was something about Heath Ledger getting really into the character and doing things like that. So I'm going to say true.
That is true. Heath Ledger locked himself away for about a month developing the character, writing a journal from the Joker's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he went down to a supermarket and found, you know, a couple of like cheap makeup-y sort of products, developed the look for it, took a photo, sent it off to Christopher Nolan. He loved it and he put it in the film. Okay, number two, true or false? Hugh Jackman was originally considered for the role of Harvey Dent.
Hmm. I can't remember when this came out, but it would have had to have been after the X-Men, the popularity of X-Men.
That's correct. It also came out after The Prestige, which did have was directed by Nolan and had Hugh Jackman in it.
Hmm.
I'm not saying that's a hint. I'm not saying it's not a hint.
Yeah.
But that's what happened. Could be a red herring.
Hugh Jackman as Harvey Dent. See, yeah, like, I don't know whether he would have been typecasted as, like, a muscle-bound, you know, Wolverine type at this time or not.
2008.
I'm just going to say that's true.
That is true.
I just figure that they would have wanted as much star power as possible, but... Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so after working with him on The Prestige, he was in early talks to take on the role, but I believe scheduling conflicts stopped him from being in it, and I think that boiled down to he was being Wolverine again for, like, the billionth time. So,
oh,
yeah.
Man, hopefully... Was that for the Wolverine Origins, the first one?
I think it was.
That's brutal, man. Like, that...
Because it was either that or it would have been X-Men for... it would have been X-Men 3, which is nearly as bad, like...
Yeah, but he had to be in X-Men 3, but... Yeah, for that, that wasn't nearly as bad as the first Wolverine movie.
Yeah, Origins was pretty terrible.
Oh, jeez, yep.
So there you go. That being said, the character has made him a squillion dollars, so even with the bad films, I still would be happy with that.
Okay.
True or false number 3, you're going really well, 2 for 2. True or false, the Batsuit's redesign was written into the film because the previous suit had been less functional and needed to be redeveloped for the actor.
The Batsuit's redesign was written into the film.
So do you recall the Batsuit being changed in the film? If you think back, there's a lot of... You know, this should be an easy one.
I vaguely recall... Yes. I think that's true, because in the first one they had... Yeah, no, okay, yeah. There was a scene where Morgan Freeman shows up and says something about, like, the Batsuit needs to be... more agile, but slightly less bulletproof, or whatever, or something.
Yes, you are true. The it is true.
So, okay.
Yeah, the line you're thinking of is he rocks up with the new designs, and Lucius is like, "You want to be able to turn your head," and he's like, "Well, it'd make backing out of the driveway a lot easier."
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. I do remember that now. Yeah.
So, basically, with
where was that line about the bullet thing? Was that in the first movie then?
No, that is, they do talk about it, like, they talk about how the separation of the plates would make him more vulnerable to knives and gunfire.
Okay, so that is in the second one, right?
That is in the second film, yeah.
All right, good.
So, yeah, they decided to redesign the suit just because, for the longest time, Batman, the movie suit, had been a hood. And I've actually worn a hooded Batman suit, and it's very, very difficult to turn your head.
Mm.
You have to turn your whole body. And so they thought, okay, what would be a brilliant idea is if we made it more of like a motorcycle helmet that you just fit over your head and the neck pieces are separate so you can turn your head. Now, after wearing a hood and then going to the helmet neck system like I have on my bat suit as well, it is so much easier, Tommy, and you can turn your head. So it's pretty good. All right, that's 3 for 3, buddy.
Cool.
Going up to number 4, true or false? Christopher Nolan destroyed one of only 3 IMAX cameras in existence during filming.
Hmm. I know that they did use IMAX cameras, right?
They did, yes.
Yeah, that was a news story around that time. I can see that. I'm just going to say true. I can see that happening. I think Christopher Nolan is a pretty hands-on director with that kind of stuff, isn't he?
It is true. They did destroy an IMAX camera. And then they later filmed The Dark Knight Rises, where they destroyed another one. So I believe...
Do you know how they destroyed them?
Yeah, both during car chases. So the Catwoman stunt double, when she was on the Batpod, she ran into one. And mm-hmm. that was during The Dark Knight Rises. And in The Dark Knight, during the chase scene with the Joker and he explodes the truck flips over.
Yeah, I remember that scene.
Yeah, I think that's when they destroyed the other IMAX camera.
Okay.
And I believe, and this may be incorrect, but I think the other IMAX camera was destroyed on one of the Transformers sets. So if they are still using IMAX cameras, it's because they had to make new ones. So okay. There you go. Okay, man, that's 4 for 4.
We're doing all right. This has been okay.
We're doing pretty
My
good.
My instincts have been decent.
Your stats are going up. Your stats are going up. All right, number 5, true or false. Michael Keaton, the Batman from the 1989 film, was meant to make a cameo in The Dark Knight, but had to reschedule at the last minute.
I don't think this can be true. I'm going to say false.
It was false. How did you get...
I think because I don't...
I tried to trick you.
You're talking about instincts, and this is purely instinctual. Because I don't think they would have ever considered him... Like, that kind of... I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, it was correct.
I guess it's... you can explain to me. Maybe that'll explain some of my thought process. But I kind of can't put any specific finger on why I think this is false.
Well, there's always been a petition to try and get Adam West in a Batman film. Because they feel that, like, he is an important part of the heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was coming up with that false, I was sort of trying to base it a little bit in reality. So... But yeah, Michael Keaton hasn't had much to do with Batman for a long time. Doesn't hate the character, still enjoys talking about it. But yeah, maybe that was why. And then he did Birdman, which is sort of like a commentary on what goes on with superheroes. So maybe that sort of filtered into your thoughts there.
Yeah, I know. Like, it's interesting coming being a part of this segment because, like, for an instant in my mind, I kind of make up stuff like. Yeah, no, I think I heard rumors about that happening when it came out, but no, that's probably all just bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's all there to trick you, Tommy.
But yeah, so I was like, that's not no. So yeah, that was purely instinctual. I don't have any basis to make that decision.
There you go.
Lucky guess, I suppose.
All right, number 6, 6 for 6, Tommy. You've only been able to do this twice, so we'll see how you go. Heath Ledger, before his unfortunate death, had only completed some of the filming. So was some CGI trickery employed to fill in the blanks?
Well, okay, so when he died, there was a lot of news about, you know, this kind of thing. I think it's... false, because I'm pretty sure he was done with Batman, but he was doing that other movie. He died in the middle of that one, which was
Dr. Parnassus.
Yes, and some other dream. Yeah, it had a long name, but
yes. Tommy, you have got 6 for 6.
Booyah!
You win the trivia prize for this week.
Which is nothing.
That is correct. There was a lot of fear about Heath Ledger not having completed the role.
Mm.
But those fears were unjustified. He'd even done ADR for it. So it was, you know, 99.9% completed. So they didn't have to do anything else. But you are absolutely correct with the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which was directed by Terry Gilliam. They did actually have to bring in other actors to complete the role. And they wrote that into the script after his unfortunate death. And that completes the movie trivia for this week. Pat yourself on the back. You did really well. And let us know how you went at home, if you were playing at home. Now, Tommy, make us feel better after talking about...
Oh, yeah. I almost forgot about this.
You have another heartwarming tale for us.
Okay, this one's actually really awesome. Okay, so... it happened in November of last year, which... isn't very topical, but I only found out about it recently. And it's such a good example of dealing with annoying assholes. That kind of, it's just kind of a, timeless kind of thing. So, this tale takes place in the land of Bavaria, where every year, for about 25 years, I think, neo-Nazis hold a march. Now, in a small town called Wonsiedel, or, I probably screwed up that pronunciation, but anyway, in that town, the residents decided to perfectly punk the right-wing extremists that were going to do the march. Do they use violence, anger and hostility? No, they used the neo-Nazis' own march against them by sponsoring the march itself. With every step, a 10 euro donation is placed to the Exit Deutschland program, which helps people escape extremist groups. The beauty is that the marchers didn't find out about this until they entered the town, and by then it was kind of too late to stop. And in the end, they inadvertently raised over 12,000 euros to a program to combat themselves.
Suck it.
It's so perfect, isn't it? Like that's how you handle these kind of people. You don't, you know, no one was hurt. They even offered, like, they had, like, bananas and stuff offered to the marchers just so that they would have enough energy to complete the march fully.
That is just
so good.
Look, my hats off to that entire town. And honestly, like, why aren't we fielding these guys to be, like, politicians? Because they this is the perfect example of people trying to make the world a better place while at the same time making morons who want to make the world look terrible, making them look like idiots.
Yeah.
It can't be any more perfect than that.
And it's using their, like, it's just using the enemy's work against them. It's brilliant. Like, no one gets hurt, nothing, you know, bad happened. It was just perfect. We need it. Like, I would love to see more of this kind of action going on all over the world.
Absolutely. And I mean, the brilliance of it is as well, is that for the plan to succeed, they needed the assholes to do what assholes generally will, and that's be assholes. So they were there. They didn't have to counter protest. They didn't have to yell or scream or get violent. All they had to do was keep those people marching. And I love it. I love it. That was just fantastic, guys. Like, really.
So good.
And look, that's a fantastic organization too, helping people get out of extremist groups. The world is suffering at the moment because of extremist groups. Do you actually have the name of the charity, Tommy?
Yeah, it was the Exit Deutschland program. You can Google that and donate to that if you want.
Yeah, it sounds like a fantastic...
Basically just helps, you know, the people that are, like, I guess, stuck in those extremist groups a way to escape that kind of environment. So
You go. If you'd like to help out a worthwhile cause and support really intelligent, funny people, because there's an element of humor to this story, jump online and give them some support. That's just fantastic. All right, Tommy. Well, that concludes the Modern Meltdown for this week. Our listeners may have noticed that we've been a little bit shorter this week than we normally do. Tell us in the comments on the website, on Twitter. You can find us at Modern Meltdown. You can join our Facebook group, The Modern Meltdown, on Facebook. We're there as a group as well as an account, so you can talk to us either way. Let us know in those comments whether you'd like us to keep the longer form podcast or whether you like this shorter version.
Yeah, or just tell us anything.
Absolutely.
You know, comment on the story, you know, maybe suggest something for us to talk about that you're interested in. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, if there's a story or if there's something that you'd like us to cover, we are more than happy to do all the research and have a chat about it. And yeah, like Tommy said, if you want to post photos of, say, your cosplay, or if you've got a comic book, or if you're an artist, or if you're a game designer, or you want to sort of reach out, contact the show, and maybe we can even organize to have you on as a guest. So make sure that you keep communicating with us, because we've got Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're also on YouTube now, so the first two podcasts of this recording are up on YouTube, so you can actually listen on YouTube as well, because we want to make sure that everyone can access it. That's why if you use your SoundCloud app, we're on SoundCloud. We're on iTunes. We're on YouTube. So we're on archive.org. So many, many ways for you to check us out. Also go to our website, themodernmeltdown.com, where hopefully we're going to have a really cool announcement soon concerning a little project that we're trying to get up and running for the webpage. You can also comment on the webpage. Send us ideas about what sections you'd like for the webpage, because it's only brand new. So many ways you can interact with us, and we'd love to actually hear from everybody out there listening to
the podcast. Yeah, it's lonely out there on the internet, guys.
It is. We're like, we're on a drift of technology. I mean, even with podcasting now, Tommy, how many podcasts are out there now? How many podcasts are out there now after the success of Serial?
Well, yeah, well, even before then. Like, you go on about that show so much, man, but, like, it's podcasting was a big thing before that show arrived.
True, but now it's like everyone knows what a podcast is. More so.
Whatever.
You know. So, yeah, that pretty much brings us to the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening. I've been Matthew Soule.
Do the Mario!
And for all you 90s children, that was Tommy Din. And we'll catch you next week for the Modern Meltdown.
Swing your arms from side to side. Come on, it's time to go. Do the Mario. Take one step and then again. Let's do the Mario all together now.